And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As Labor Day weekend approaches, we're going to give you a lot to choose from with all that weekend holiday leisure time. We take a quick look at what's happening in the Grand Sequoias, then off on one of the greatest adventures as we follow a caribou herd, and then we start unlocking the secrets of the wisdom of the great apes. It's the best nature talk show in the world. Keep on the path as the Wild Side News takes you where you always want to go.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're heading for a wrap on summer vacation. I'm already hearing the whispers from some that it seems summers keep speeding up, and perhaps we're beginning to associate late summer with the beginning of hurricane season, and things are beginning to speed up there, as Hurricane Ernesto makes a less than sensational stand and heads on up into the Carolinas. As the news media scrambles to find a new sensation after the JonBenet case fell off the screen, the world of hurricanes actually is beefing up for yet another real season. A couple of weeks ago, China had the worst cyclone in 50 years, and as we speak, the Baja is getting ripped up by Hurricane John. So keep in mind, hurricane season is not just a U.S. phenomenon. In many respects, this is becoming another big storm year. As Ernesto fizzles, that's good news. So too, the oil prices that were poised to jump back up if the storm headed into the Gulf. Some more good news is that oil prices are reaching a new low for this season, as some predict a return to the mid-60s. By the way, what happened to the BP pipeline factor? So, things seem to be returning to normal, kind of. We've got three great stories coming up. Following the news, we're up to the Great Sequoia Redwood Forests to explore the recent decision by a federal judge to back the demands of the Sierra Club that the world's most significant collection of Grand Sequoias not be given over to the new Forest Service management practices that would have cut down the old growth to keep them from burning. And then in segment two, every once in a while, the Wild Side News takes you on an extended journey. We've gone in depth and spent an entire show following a great story. We've brought you some truly exceptional immersions. Well, we want to be sure you get a sense of what these journeys are like. So today, we're bringing you two teasers that may spark your interest in hearing the rest of the story. So in segment two, we introduce you to one of our longest such adventures as we follow the plans of two wildly adventurous newlyweds who spent their first months of marriage heading off on foot to follow the secret journey of the porcupine caribou herd from their summer range in Canada to their calving area in the legendary Arctic Wildlife Refuge. You'll hear the words of the adventurer himself, Carsten Hauer, and may just be inclined to want to keep on going along with him and his wife as they finish the tale. And then you'll find out what drives a legendary researcher in search of the intelligence of apes from its roots in a raw research lab with monkeys trying to figure out what in the world was supposed to happen to the moment when the researcher himself realized he had missed the amazing intelligence of his subjects and totally transformed his approach. We give you two entrees to adventure in this special sampler edition of the Wild Side News. It's all coming up following the news. So now, the news. 100 African elephants were found dead in five separate killing grounds in Chad, not far from the border of Sudan, which has experienced its own human massacre for years. The discoveries were made near Chad's Zakouma National Park, one of the animal's most northern ranges in Central Africa. Wildlife groups say a rise in illicit ivory sales globally is being driven by a new demand from China. an expedition in 2005 counted 3,885 elephants in Zakuma, but a year later, researchers found just over 3,000. The park is located in the path of recent rebel activity in Chad, which has reduced the security in the area, which would otherwise have protected the animals. And in Alaska, two conservation groups filed a lawsuit to stop the killing of native wolves, which has been sanctioned by the Alaska State Board of Game. Over 550 wolves have been killed so far. The season on wolves was authorized reportedly to help increase the caribou and moose population, which proponents of the culling claim have been reduced due to overpopulation of wolves and bears, which kill the young. Critics of the hunt say it is aimed at wiping out more than 80% of wolves in a large section of Alaska to benefit mostly urban hunters who want an easy time getting to the moose and caribou. Defenders of wildlife claim that the claims about diminishing caribou and moose populations is based on faulty science. Under the program, the state issues permits which allow pilots and gunners to shoot wolves from the air or to spot them, land, and shoot them. Numbers for this year's hunt have not been set. No, the Center for Animal Transgenesis is not something out of a Jurassic Park remake. It is a program administered by the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, which has recently demonstrated that rat sperm cells transplanted into mice testicles can produce viable rat sperm that has successfully fathered healthy rats through micro-insemination with female rat eggs. Pay attention. So what's this mean? It gets even stranger, kind of. One application holds the potential for healthy sperm to be grown in donor testes of other animals, thus advancing the science of endangered species management. And it also means that much food could be saved by growing sperm from, let's say, male cattle in, for example, mice testes. And so it goes. It could lead to the effective elimination of most male humans, as human sperm could be grown in, well, we'll just have to wait and see just how far-reaching this new transgenesis project may lead. Researchers making recordings of a lone killer whale in the Nootka Sound area of Vancouver Island have announced that the animal effectively mimicked the sound of an adult sea lion, thus proving that killer whales can learn to produce unorca-like sounds, a feat considered rare among mammals. Unfortunately, the ability to study this unique vocal vocabulary was terminated when Luna, the friendly whale, was struck and killed by a tugboat propeller in March. Luna is fondly remembered as a friendly whale that followed boats and interacted with local residents. Her legacy will be forever held as advancement in science of animal behavior. And in Manila, 15,000 prisoners are having their heads shaved bald in response to a national emergency. No, they are not being prepared for extermination due to prison budget cuts. Rather, they are answering a call from the Philippine government to amass tons of hair and feathers to absorb more than 50,000 gallons of industrial fuel that leaked from a tanker when it sank off the central island of Guaymas in mid-August. Barbershops and salons are getting into the environmental cleanup effort by saving their clippings, while schools are asking students as well to shave their heads bald to help in the environmental cleanup efforts. Environmentalism has a shiny new look in the Philippines. And that's the news. And a few reminders. Next week, a very special show all about the new resurgence of a sense of wilderness that's bringing people together across the country. We bring you three voices for the wilderness as plans are being made to head to Washington, D.C. for Wilderness Week in the nation's capital. It's a show you'll definitely want to tune into. So now, let's head on out to California's Grand Sequoia and Redwood Country, where the battles to keep the grandest living things standing is seeing some grand success. Last week, a federal judge in San Francisco made a ruling that challenges a lot of the Bush administration's strategies for forest management. And in this particular case, it had to do with a decision that related to the giant Sequoia National Monument. Joining us from San Francisco is an attorney who worked on that with the Sierra Club, Pat Gallagher. Pat, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Why don't you give us a little history about Giant Sequoia National Monument? It truly is a unique spot. President Clinton established this in 2000. It's a relatively large monument, 328,000 acres. Why don't you take it from there in terms of giving us a sense of the significance of this particular public land?
Probably the most significant aspect of it is that it contains somewhere between a half and two-thirds of all the giant sequoias in the world. Giant sequoias only grow in a narrow band in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. As folks probably know, they're the largest plant organism on the face of the earth. They're actually bigger in bulk than the coastal redwoods, even though they're not quite as tall. They're this incredibly magnificent species of tree, and the monument contains about 30 or 40, I don't know the exact number, distinct groves of sequoias, and then interspersed with that, huge belts of sugar pine, white fir, and then quite a bit of chaparral, caves, beautiful river canyons, tons of wildlife. So the whole thing is just a spectacular setting. And it's actually sandwiched in between Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Park. So, you know, it's a real treasure. It's not only a national treasure, you know, given that this is the only place on Earth they grow. It's a worldwide treasure.
Why was this not set up as part of the national park system originally?
Well, the park itself was set up around the turn of the century. And I just think that expectations and ambitions were, you know, a little bit less dramatic back at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the resources to manage such a big area just weren't there.
Mm-hmm. But there was pressure to have this set aside as a national monument, and it was Bill Clinton, President Clinton, did that in 2000. And this does obviously provide certain protections, therefore, from logging. However, as we know, many of these various regulations and mandates are continually being chiseled away at by the Bush administration, who is kind of changing the law by changing management strategies. This became part of the Healthy Forest Initiative. That was sort of the way in which they began to feel that they were doing the right thing by logging.
The Bush administration has promoted commercial logging in the guise of fire management.
Correct.
And it's a real hoax on the American people.
It is a concession to the timber industry. So in this particular case, actually logging had begun.
It's a little bit complicated, so let me back up a few steps.
Sure.
So the monument was created in April of 2000. And when Clinton created the monument, he carved out an exception for what, for lack of a better word, we'll call grandfathered timber sales. These are timber sales that had been approved in the late 90s, right before the monument was created. And he said in the monument proclamation that those could go forward on the terms that were in existence at that time.
Well, that's challenging.
Right. So there was a few thousand acres of logging that kind of got grandfathered in. But the idea was that logging was necessary to transition the local mill for a couple of years, like, you know, through 2002 or whatever, so that they could then, you know, move into some sort of new source of timber or, you know, retool themselves to deal with different size wood. But what happened was during that time period, and we're talking, you know, circa 2001, timber prices were really depressed. So what happened was the industry just sat on those timber sales. They didn't act on them. And then, so basically did not log the area. And then fast forward to 2005, 5 years later, after the monument was created, and the Bush administration passed this broader management plan for prospective management, not the grandfathered sales, but all the new commercial logging that they were going to do. So we geared up to sue to challenge that prospective plan, and then all of a sudden we found out from some local citizens down there that they were already logging, and so obviously, you know, we were kind of dumbfounded. And then we found out that what they had done is they had resurrected the grandfathered sales that they never acted on, and that they decided, well, they better cut them now. So we marched into court and sought preliminary injunctions, TROs, to stop that logging.
Now, is that against the logging companies, per se?
No, it's all Forest Service. The Forest Service is the defendant in all the cases because they are the they're the agency that's approving the action.
All right, gotcha.
The timber companies basically just sign a contract with the Forest Service to buy the timber from them.
Okay.
So technically, there's kind of two pieces to this lawsuit. One was going after the grandfathered sales, and then the other piece, which is in some respects the more major piece, is stopping this prospective plan that deals with all 300 and some odd thousand acres of the monument. And so the rationale for stopping the grandfathered sales was that Fish and Wildlife Service in 2004, so just a couple of years ago, acknowledged that the Pacific fisher, which is a cousin of the wolverine, it's a very rare mammal that lives in the monument, was on the verge of extinction, and that it really needed draconian protection. And the grandfathered timber sales that we challenged were based on all this outdated science from the mid-90s with respect to the Pacific fisher. So we came in and said, well, you can't cut in 2005 after your own agency has determined that this animal is on the verge of extinction and just ignore all that science. You're going to drive this animal, you know, into oblivion. And the judge agreed with us on that. So he shut down all the grandfathered timber sales on that basis. Mm-hmm. They don't offer enough protection for this rare animal.
Mm-hmm. Besides the grandfathered timber sales, there hadn't really been an effort to expand and kind of use the Healthy Forest Initiative to promote thinning within the groves.
Well, no, they couldn't do that until the monument plan was free and clear and finally approved. And they had started to develop some projects under the new monument plan. The first one that we were worried about was something called the Whitaker Project. And that was a project they were actually going to go into one of the Sequoia Groves, the Redwood Mountain Grove. And they were going to cut trees up to 30 inches in diameter, which are, you know, huge trees by today's standards. These forests have been so cut over that a 30-inch diameter tree, I mean, just hearing that in the abstract is kind of hard to imagine, but sometime if you're out in the forest and you go up to a tree and get a sense of how big a tree is, if it's 30 inches across the middle of the trunk, that's a huge tree.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so this Whitaker Project called for the cutting of trees up to 30 inches in diameter, and so we protested loudly and submitted all kinds of comments at the so-called scoping stage of that. And what happened was, because of this litigation, they just kind of put that project on ice. So nothing has really happened as far as the prospective management and the kind of thinning that they, you know, were planning to do. And now with this latest ruling, everything's back to the drawing board.
This concept of the thinning that is behind the Healthy Forest Initiative, in an ancient grove like this, where you have such towering, massive trees, I don't know that the science would support that is a legitimate way to prevent forest fires. These trees have been around for thousands of years and have adapted themselves to withstand forest fires with foot to 2 foot bark. Were you able to use any of that type of science to make your case?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about this topic. I mean, the first message that I always want to get across is that the Sierra Club and all of our allies, nobody's interested in having towns and houses burn up. You know, everybody's interested in having communities be protected. But we believe, and there's science to back it up, that they're actually increasing the risk of fire. And the reason for that is the kind of logging that's called for. When you go in and you log 30-inch trees, and you reduce the forest canopy, which is essentially the shade layer overhead, when you reduce that pretty dramatically, you end up with a much hotter, drier environment, and you end up with a lot of debris on the ground, and then you end up with a lot of bushy undergrowth growing up because the sunlight's penetrating to the floor. That's prime fire conditions. That's how big fires start, is with hot, dry surface fuel. So we have won, actually, a number of cases in the last couple of years where the judges have recognized that logging large trees and opening up and drying out the forest not only doesn't prevent fire, it actually exacerbates fire.
I am a scientist, but there's only so much that I can know. And when I think about thinning in a forest, I typically think of removing lower brush. But I guess in this particular case, the way that this is being interpreted and and actually happening in the field, is thinning means taking out large trees.
You know, the way that I tend to think of it, and I can't say that this is exactly true in all instances. I think what's happening is that you've got the Forest Service having mixed intentions. They've got, you know, partly benevolent intentions. I mean, they're interested in controlling fires, so they want to get in there and they want to clear out the small diameter stuff, the brush, the undergrowth, which is really the problem, the fuel for forest fires. But they don't have the money to do that. So where are they going to get the money? Well, the way they get the money is they sell the big trees. So one odd analogy that I've used is it's like selling one of your organs, like selling a kidney to pay for your health club membership. So they're selling the heart of the forest so that they can clean up the forest. It really makes no sense at all.
This actually changes my perception of what was being done, and thanks for educating me, in the sense that thinning actually means taking out large timber. Therefore, as you say, that canopy is gone and suddenly everything, the whole ecosystem is radically changed.
Right. There's a couple other, I think, key points to make on this front. One is that what we're pushing for is that the monument be managed just like the national park is managed. And then again, the national park is right next door. And the National Park Service has developed methods for using prescribed fire, where you do controlled burns and you burn out the sort of the spindly undergrowth and the surface fuels, and very selective thinning, and no logging of large trees. And the Park Service is incredibly successful. They've really learned how to manage fire. They've got a really healthy forest. They've got great regeneration of sequoia trees. So that's the model. And I think the Forest Service is gradually sort of being dragged, kicking and screaming, to that model. And I hope that this lawsuit victory, you know, kind of moves them further in that direction. And then the other key, I think, point for the audience to understand is that the giant sequoia ecosystem actually needs fire. Giant sequoia cones will not germinate, will not open and spread their seeds unless they're subject to fire. So it's an ecosystem that actually evolved with fire. And so to remove fire from that ecosystem, you know, would be the height of folly.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's many pines in particular where that's exactly the process, and it's a requirement. Well, this is also is interesting in the sense that apparently there must be different management policies for national monuments versus national parks. Am I right about that in terms of this concept of allowing these logging management practices?
Yeah, well, obviously, the National Park Service is not in the business of selling timber. The Forest Service is. And unfortunately, this national monument is under the management of the Forest Service. I mean, that's the real problem.
So part of your effort, then, in terms of the Sierra Club and others and people who are concerned about the sequoia trees, if anybody hasn't seen a sequoia or a redwood, it's life-critical that you go see these things because it changes your perspective on many different things. And there are many people who really appreciate the extraordinary significance of every single tree. You can really sense that to lose one of these grand old trees that have been around in some cases for thousands of years, it's hard for me to comprehend that we can let something like that go. Really, the best protection, then, is to have this somehow transferred over to the National Park Service.
Yeah, I mean, that would be ideal. And at a minimum, managed exactly like the Park Service manages it.
What's the prospect of that? What's involved in that process?
Oh, that would probably require action by Congress or some sort of, you know, interagency agreement between the Forest Service and the Park Service. And that's a campaign that's just getting started, and that we hope to promote over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, if people wanted to help in that process, what would you recommend?
They should visit the Sierra Club website. If they visit our page, which is Sierra Club /environmental law, and they can send us an email, and we can put them in touch with people that are working on the campaign.
Do you think that this particular ruling is going to hold in terms of this lawsuit concerning Giant Sequoia National Monument?
Oh, sure. And I think that it's so well-reasoned and decisive that it would be a real mistake for them to even try to appeal.
Well, Pat Gallagher, attorney with the Sierra Club, who's been prime in terms of getting this ruling in favor of the Giant Sequoia National Monument. Good work. If there's anything that I can do, please let me know.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay, get ready for adventure as we start two journeys that explore the depths of our world when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.